Welcome to CounselorAudioSource.net. Counselor Audio Source is a weekly podcast dedicated to the professional enhancement of practicing counselors, supervisors, and counselor educators. Look for us on the web at CounselorAudioSource.net. I'm Dr. Marty Gentius at Kent State University, and this week on Counselor Audio Source, Dr. Shannon Dermer, contributing editor, has a conversation with Dr. Cyrus Ellis, both of Governor State University, about black male authenticity.
Dr. Ellis, I'd like you to explain to me a little bit about what exactly you mean by the term black male authenticity.
Black male authenticity, again, for me, and even some shared comments and thoughts with other colleagues in psychology and sociology that I've come to know, we recognize that the black male as a critical event in the culture of America has multiple connotations to it, and it has multiple meanings also. When one considers another to be black, what does that mean becomes the next question. And for some, black males could be like it's portrayed in the pop culture and videos and music. It could be what you see portrayed in movies and television dramas. Before we had the Grey's Anatomy type, black phenotype, we had Starsky and Hutch, and we had Huggy Bear and all those kinds of things. To be black, to be streetwise, the good times, being black, and so forth. So black male authenticity really refers to the issue of what does it truly mean to be black authentically outside of a race-based understanding of what blackness is. And when that applies itself to males, we try to go beyond what has been broadcast to us via various mediums, like I've already said.
Okay, so you think that in society there definitely hasn't been an authentic portrayal in a lot of cases of what the black male is like and what his values are?
Oh, most certainly. It goes back to what I call three syndromes. You have a Tiger Woods syndrome. You have the Urkel syndrome. And then you have, of course, the Roots syndrome, you know, and taking the three in order from Tiger Woods, you have a black man by all visual depiction who early in his career, when asked what was he, because he understands his heritage from both mom and dad, speaks to that heritage. Well, black folk went crazy. We got to explain why I use black folk in another word in a minute. But they went crazy because they tried to make sure that what a lot of large amount of black community wanted was Tiger Woods, who after he won the Masters and won a lot of golf tournaments early in his career, went on Oprah, and that's really where the big blow up happened. And what they really wanted by their expressions were they wanted him to acknowledge his blackness as they understood blackness, not as Tiger Woods understood blackness, so that black folk could be validated, because golf was a game that we were told we were not sophisticated enough and intellectual enough to play and be successful. Here you have a young man who is black by what we see, mastering the game, if you will, by winning the Masters, and does not on stage claim his blackness. That's an authenticity question. With Urkel from the show Family Matters, one of the longest running nighttime comedy show where black folk were the stars in the history of television, longer than Good Times, longer than the Jeffersons, Urkel was not seen as truly black because he was a little bit nerdy, sinus problems, loved cheese, suspenders, but very, very smart. His alter ego came on the show halfway through its run, Stefan, who was more black in terms of style and quality than Urkel was. And then, of course, you got the Roots syndrome, where we were seen to be very strong, very rugged, and very durable to do the forced manual labor that Roots depicted. So, and that even goes back to maybe not in your time, but mine. Jimmy the Greek was a sports announcer on CBS who said that on TV in the early 80s, that the reason why blacks are so good at being linemen and all that, because they were bred to be that way. So you have these three varying degrees of authenticity, and the young folk and even other folk have a hard time recognizing who are they really when it comes to a variety of social issues. So that's that's why authenticity is very important.
Okay, so you're talking about that sometimes some successful figures play down their black identity, and that minimizes in a lot of ways the view of success or what we can be, or in some ways feels like it's minimizing that person's identity. And then you said you have like other attributes like with Urkel that have been associated
with
being
not
smart,
being black.
And then therefore not being
exactly.
black, or that something some of the shows reinforce the idea that black folk can only be in a certain way or can only achieve through like sports or something physical.
Some physical strength-based means, not intellectual means.
Okay. So what? Before we move on more mm-hmm. to authenticity and why that's important, especially for black men in this society, why do you keep using the term like black men and black folk when some people would say, oh, it should be African-American?
Well, I can dig the fact that people want to use African American to link it to a people, not a color. But the sad part for me is that from Du Bois' work as Souls of Black Folk, we have a problem in America with the color line. And African American as a title really falls into that color line, because when you look at brown-skinned, dark-skinned people, the assumption in our cultural context is African-American. They can be from Barbados, they can be from Cameroon, they could be from South America. But we, in our culture, it's a race-based culture in a lot of ways, like as it is monetarily, as it is based on gender, as it is based on ability. And we see somebody who's dark-skinned and they have the hair that looks like, or the lips that look like, or even, if I may, the butts that look like, and we assume African-American. And I'm not saying that's a bad thing. I'm saying that it puts everybody into a grouping yet again. I use black folk to deal with the color line issues, and some folk can understand it, some folks struggle with it. I know for my Caucasian brothers and sisters to just go around saying black this, black that, they might get viewed a lot of different ways, but that's the world we live in. And I can't sit in front of a class and say African American in a room full of 30 people, and I don't know where these brown-skinned people have come from, but the only reason I would use the term is because I'm seeing brown-skinned people.
Right.
So I try not to do that. I do say black folk, and then when I'm allowed to speak longer than whatever time, I do qualify why I use the phrase like I'm doing now, but I'm not going to recreate something that we already know is problematic.
Okay, so you're saying then in some ways actually saying the term like black folk or black people is actually more inclusive, because it doesn't say anything about, like, if they're from Haiti, they're not African, you know, necessarily African-American or Panama.
Or even American,
for
that matter.
Right. Or American.
So I don't bring them into a grouping. I know, again, I understand why. You got to say, I've been black all my life.
And thanks for clarifying.
Yeah, we went from, you know, from the N-word to Negroid to Negro to Afro to this is a constant shift. Again, trying to get to authenticity, not trying to get to category in a census. People want to be known by who they truly are. And, you know, Irish Americans and German Americans and all that kind of stuff, that's great. I don't have a problem with it. But typically, until you say I'm German American, you see a Caucasian person. And I was just teaching the class this weekend, and somebody, until they state they're Polish, we see white or we see black. That's our context. Let's not hide from it. Let's recognize that's how we categorize. And of course, if you're white and then you're German, or if you're white and then you're Jewish, we have another degree of discrimination to work with. But
okay, you started off this conversation talking a little bit about what authenticity isn't, or mm-hmm. how people have been misled about the authentic identity of black folk in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
So we kind of know what it's not. How would you say that we should be helping people to represent an authentic black identity, especially black male identity?
This is a synthesized response from the years and the work I've done in a variety of places. One of the things that helped me answer this question that you just posed to me was working with Dr. Cornel West, and I'm not trying to imply we hang out and play golf, but we did do some work in 2003, and in his book Race Matters, which is a text from my cultural class, one of the two I use, he speaks of the way to get to authenticity as a matter of morality, not religious morality, not in terms of legal morality, but in terms of a conversion of the heart, where we embrace the historical pieces of ourselves, not the promoted pieces of ourselves. And that requires some intervention with regard to what Dr. West coins historical amnesia. We have to recognize that we are, and I think I had a hard time when I was young because of the culture I was coming up in, to accept my tribal origin, whether it be in Mother Africa or whether it be through the South American continent, whether it be through Puerto Rico or Haiti or wherever the winds blew the slave ships. We are tribal people, much like our Native American brothers and sisters, who understand balance is not just a matter of what we have in our hand, but how our mind is calibrated, how our heart is calibrated, how our spiritual dimension is calibrated, all working together for one balanced individual. The example Dr. West used was the Clarence Thomas debate of taking taking Thurgood Marshall's historic position on the Supreme Court and replacing it with a man who, on the surface, is authentically black because of his color, but his politics are inauthentic to the cause of black people that he represents. And that's really the strongest piece, because we don't want black faces in high places to say, look, we've made it. It's more than that. It is a matter of, is my brother my keeper? The work I do in Chicagoland between three hard-hit, economically depressed cities, have the youth of those cities fighting each other over ground that is not even theirs. Anytime they want to rezone, reclassify, or raise the income base, these folk would find themselves out, shot at each other for what reason? Because the property was never theirs. And that's the inauthenticity when we talk about Crips and Bloods and I'm down from my hood and all that kind of stuff. I understand how we got here. It's just that the intervention takes a longer look at the past. The Civil Rights Movement, Dr. King was quoted as saying, the biggest difference about the Civil Rights Movement and the greatest victory of the Civil Rights Movement was not the legislation that got put into law. It was more a matter that our minds got together. Our minds became calibrated. That's my words, not his. And that's powerful, because it is the critical incidences of life that allow a village to be a village. One of the new things I'm writing this year is a chapter called New Warriorship, and one of my own books finally this year, because it describes that we lost the connectedness of a community somewhere. I'm going to put it in the 80s when crack hit the streets, but we lost our community where a grandmother on one corner was your pseudo-grandmother until you reached your own grandmother. What Dr. West calls buffers of our society. We lost all of that. And we lost our music. We lost our origins to jazz. And we lost our origins to literature, from T.S. Eliot to George Washington Carver and what he wrote about from the science perspective, down to all the other great writers of the past. The Carter G. Woodsons, if you will, of the past, the Ella Bakers of the past. We think that that's weird. One time I was writing in Chicago, nice sunny day, and I was playing Jackie Wilson, people, and I stopped at a corner where all the young people were sitting and waiting for the bus, and they looked at me strange to hear Jackie Wilson coming out of this black man's car, because they saw blackness and they had a connotation of what I ought to be playing. But there was an old man with a cane, looked like to be in his late 60s, maybe early 70s, and when I pulled up, he was sitting still, but as the light took its sweet time, I looked back over at him and his foot began to tap with the beat. Because he remembers how we used to party, how we used to celebrate blackness in all its various shades and all its various ways, from the writings of the past to the music to the preachers to the teachers. And that's something that we have disconnected from. That's part of our amnesia that we have not yet dealt with. And although everything in the past is not the greatest, but a lot back there is good. And we lost that. So the authenticity of who we are comes from where? Most of these young folk think that being black means what they have seen in their 15, 18 years. Not 340 years. Not in 500 years. And that really kills. And it might be by design on a few people's part, but it kills who we are as a people, to me. And that kills the authenticity of how you look at crime and injustice and family and relationships and manhood and all those kinds of things. That really is what we try to fix as professional counselors. We try to fix those things, and we wonder, where did they get the thought process? The thought process is but 12 years old. That's why we have a hard time recognizing it.
Okay, so, and correct me if I'm wrong, but here's kind of what I got from what you're saying, is that authenticity, there's several parts to it. One of the biggest parts being recognizing where, you know, people came from, their history, and recognizing the commonalities that people share because of that shared history.
That's right.
But also, it sounded like you were also saying part of being authentic is advocating for other people, for other black folk, on a personal level, but also on a political level. And
a true advocacy that goes against the connotation of welfare and set aside and affirmative action. We can talk about affirmative action on the day. It needs to stay. But it matter of its origins never dealt with five whites, two blacks, and a Puerto Rican. Its origin was to remove barriers so that equality can be respected. That didn't happen. The compromise came with 5, 2, and 1.
Okay, so not just being at a political level, not just being represented, but actually getting to some of the core issues.
Exactly.
Okay.
A concrete connection with the invisible and silent people of the world.
Okay. It also sounded like you were saying part of authenticity for black folk is recognizing the strengths and successes of the people who came before you and people, you know, currently. And then also that to embrace diversity within your own community.
Exactly.
Also not think that being black only means this.
Exactly. Don't take Urkel, because it's quite profound. If I know people listening are counselor types and we do this for fun, but other people don't. But it's quite profound to look at the Family Matters Urkel syndrome. And people think I might be a nerd because I looked at it this deeply, but that's okay. But you wonder why you create the alter ego. He did that to win the love and affection of Laura, because who he was as Urkel was not the kind of man, at least as a show for years, she didn't want that kind of a black man. She never dated a white guy on the show. So Urkel was not good enough. He wasn't the kind of man she wanted to get with. All the other guys she dated on the show were a different type of black kid until he created the alter ego Stefan.
So are you implying that he wasn't black enough?
Wasn't black enough.
Okay.
Are we black enough if we go to black colleges first and then white schools second? Are we black enough if we have white women as love interests or biracial children? Are we black enough if we use our R's and our ER's in our language and our speech? Or are we seen as less than black because we're smart, have advanced degrees from white schools, or what have you? That's the question, because not only do black people ask that question, so do white people.
Right.
So that permeates all the levels of society. It sets up why I got to be true to myself and keep it real. But you're keeping it real to a false belief anyway. So the whole cultural soup that we're talking about is really quite deep when you look at what does it mean to be black. Do teachers at high schools, and I know they do, say you're an exception to the rule to some black kids who are smart and a go-getter versus the other kids who are in the hallway who are loud, pants off their butt, like the rap music? Or the one kid with a tie and a shirt who can do the assignments, is he an exception to the rule? Then that means we know what the rule is. So all these authenticity questions permeate our society, and it causes young people without grandmothers and grandfathers, solid parents or consistent parenting, to figure it out for themselves. And we have the Chappelle Show to work with. We have Fox News to work with. We have CNN to work with. We have all these different things to work with. We in rap music, oh my goodness, watch BET one full day and look at the barrage of issues that we have to deal with when it comes to authenticity of who we are as black men. Versus the pictures and images of the civil rights movement, which for me showed what kind of men we were.
Are you saying then that some of the black rappers and entertainers who only show, you know, who in some ways fit a stereotype that society has about the black man, that they're not being authentic?
I don't think in terms of legitimacy they're being authentic. I have written and tried to communicate with many rappers. Of course, they don't like to talk to academics as much as they do other venues because it's all marketed. But I've called it legitimate foolishness and a lot of times, because I understand the need for legitimacy to work at a craft that's legitimately yours, that we seem to have a monopoly on. But then what's coming out of the mouth after that? You get the stage, you get the money, but how do you make said money? It doesn't, and I'm not saying all white folk build up the race either. I watch the Girl Gone Wild commercials like everybody else, and that's not constructive to anything, is more destructive. But we have other stigmas that certain populations don't get. You go back to what I said, that exception to the rule. I call it the rule of exceptionality in my cultural classes, because when you look at Girls Gone Wild and kids acting a fool who are Caucasian, that's an exception. They're not always connoted into that this is the way these kids are. They get that in our culture. That's not what black folk get.
So you're saying that when a Caucasian kid, you know, acts the fool, that that's just seen as that kid acting foolish, not representative of
exactly.
their entire race.
Exactly. Because the same phenomena goes to when you have black folk in class, why do we expect them, by and large, to speak for black people?
Right.
But you don't require that of all your Caucasian students. And that's usually because there's one or two of us around, and they want to give us some insight into what black people. I mean, that's a large order to fill. So that's a cultural thing. But when you talk about legitimacy, they want to get their record label, they want to get their contracts, and they want to do their thing legitimately, and I can understand that. But when you have the Nellies, and I mean, I know of these rap people because the kids watch it, so I watch it. But it's really difficult, because then the attitude from this ideological scenario of a video plays out in the hallways of schools and on the parking lots of our world, and that's not a video. There are no actors, there are no directors. If those kids portray that behavior and act that way toward our young women and toward our society, they get arrested.
Okay.
They don't get another take. And that's why it's illegitimate to a point, because it doesn't bring about change for a race of people, but that becomes the view of the people.
Okay. Now, authenticity would be an issue for it sounds like all black folk, but you specifically focus on black males.
Yes.
And how important authenticity is for black males. Why do you specifically focus on men, or why do you think it's more important for men?
It began when we looked at some distressing statistics. Age groups of black males, usually about 23 to 28, half that population is in prison. The phrase that Dr. Michael Eric Dyson, someone else I've worked with and talked with, more black men in jail than at Yale. You know, that's what he likes to say, and he says more black males in the pen than at Penn. And that's important, because the title of one of those chapters I'm writing in my own book called New Warriorship, you don't have warriors in the village when you have that many black men in jail. This issue of black warriorship is really an issue of recognizing that if you have half your young men in jail, and if you have another large group of black males who don't succeed in basic education in the K-12 range, and then don't pursue baccalaureate degrees by large numbers, 80% of the degrees given to black folk at the undergraduate level fall to women. You don't have warriors for your tribe, and you got to go back into a tribal understanding of why you need warriors in the first place. Warriors protect the elders, secure the tribe, make sure the tribe can eat and the tribe can survive. Certainly the Maasai in Africa take their young men about age 11 or 12 into the bushland for 7 years to teach them the ways of being a warrior so that the tribe can always succeed. our new warriorship, if you will, is a matter of taking these young brothers and recognize the spear has been replaced with the pen. The shield has been replaced with the laptop and other variety of things to have them be able to be advocates, in the words we use today, for the people who don't have the skill set, for the old who are too old to push now. The old have done their job. They walked the streets, met the billy club, met the baseball bat, met the fire hoses. The picture, you know, although people can't see it, I have in my office over my wall reminds me when my job gets too tight that I'm not really doing too much. I'm not met with fire hoses and German shepherds. I'm met with climate controlled, and I get ticked off when my email don't work. And I call people to say, come fix it, because of who I am. It's a matter of when we write and what we do, it has to relate back to a people. That's why Dyson would say it's not about having a black man on the Supreme Court. He'd prepare to have a Jewish cat up there whose policies and practices go to the downtrodden people before I focus on the black phenotype that stands before me. Being black isn't enough in the authenticity realm. It is what are you doing with your blackness based on what you are connected to. My Jewish brothers understand that. My Italian brothers understand that. My Native American brothers understand that. What happened to us is what we don't understand.
So it's not enough just to have black representation in the media and in politics. You want people who are authentic.
You'd have to be authentic, and that scares, because we're going out of our realm into the dominant culture's realm. It's not enough to say I make $250,000 a year as a corporate CEO. The question is, when you sit at the table of decision making and you set up policies for people to improve their life condition, what kind of policies are you putting forth? Do they go to the for everyone to have a chance by their own ability, or do they go to keep the club closed because you are being reminded that we let you in and now you can't just open the door for everybody else? To have Colin Powell sit at the right hand of George Bush as he did, and Condoleezza Rice sit at his right hand as well, but on Martin Luther King's birthday that same president comes out to say there are no more affirmative action policies at Michigan or anywhere else, we will fight this on Martin Luther King's birthday, with two very smart, very strong, very active black people at the highest levels of government. Nobody, and Dyson brought this to our attention, neither one of them had enough persuasive power to say, look, man, you can't do this today. Do it the day before. Do it the day after. But don't do it on the day we celebrate the man who's walked for freedom. That's the day you're going to talk about affirmative action, when you yourself are the very product of cronyism and affirmative action from an elitist standpoint. That's where the inauthenticity comes. And that's why we look at presidents the way we do. Are they real or are they not real? Obama, love him like we do. His question, once he decides to be a full-fledged candidate, will be what kind of black man is going to be in the White House. That will be the question. No different than a woman getting in there. You're not going to elect a feminist to be president of the United States. Old white men would freak out that she's going to turn back the tables of time and make it even for women because they understand the history. Somehow they do, and they do their things to protect it. Somehow we argue about how much history we should know. They didn't want Lieberman as president. Why? Question about having a Jewish person as president. America's already aligned with Israel. What would we do if a Jewish cat was up there? Would he have more allegiance to Israel or to America? Kennedy in 63, same question. Can a Catholic be a good president? Why? Catholics are loyal to the Pope, not loyal to America. It's always been an authenticity question. It will always be an authenticity question. Am I black enough for you? That's always going to be the question. When black males, getting to the point, when black males live in this kind of what I call contradictory rules of engagement, when they can't be Urkel and be seen as black enough, they can't be gay and be seen as black enough, can't be smart and seen as black enough, we start to do some ridiculous things to earn our street cred.
Okay.
So that we can be black enough.
Do you?
And that's where we get in trouble.
Do you think, it sounds like in some ways that you're saying in the United States, in order for a black man to gain power, he almost has to be inauthentic.
It has been put to us in a variety of ways that being true to blackness, and I'm talking not about, again, the skin color, not talking about the neighborhood you come out of, talking about what you say, what you've learned and how do you use what you've learned is where people question. You know what a militant is. We have jokes about it on various TV shows, and Living Color was one and others, where the militant would come up and they say, let's go make a snowman. And somebody yells out, the first snowman was black. The white man made it a white snowman. The first snowman. See, all of that is militant because everything you say is questioned and everything you say is brought up as not true because his story was never her story to begin with. And his story isn't our story. So we want to put the anti-thought to everything it said. That's seen as being militant and hostile. And we don't know if we want that kind of black person.
So is there someone you can think of offhand, or who is someone you can think of offhand that that is a model of an authentic black man who also is powerful or is very known and seen?
Well, that's a good and difficult question to answer because the issue we have, I mean, Farrakhan, just to throw some names out, not to say I'm ranking him, but Farrakhan is authentically black, but not seen as ultimately successful, unless you work within a certain sect of the Muslim community. Obama is seen as very black and very successful, but seen as middle of the road, and maybe does not speak often enough about the pain, oppression, and degradation of his people that he is a part of. Then you have Colin Powell out of Harlem, who grew up in a segregated military, at least segregated environment in his military career, and was not seen as black enough. Lovie Smith, Chicago Bears, I think he has a Caucasian woman as his wife. Maybe not, black coach, yes, first time two black men coach in a Super Bowl, but are they black enough? Lovie might get the street cred because he's in football versus someone else.
So you're saying just by getting a powerful position, people question whether they are authentic?
They do. I mean, I've had the questions. All of my educational credentials came out of white institutions. Some people say, why did you go just to all white institutions? Why didn't you go to a Howard or Spelman? I mean, that's for girls, Morehouse.
Wanted to go to Spelman.
Wanted to go to Spelman. Just hang out around Spelman. But, you know, and are you black enough because you didn't go there? And you know, are you black enough because you did go to a black college but not black enough because you didn't pledge? If you did pledge fraternities, are you truly black enough? I mean, all of these are the questions that come down upon our shoulders as black men because it relates to who we relate to with the female category if that's the direction we move in. If we want guys, well, we already know the stigma of being on the down low and the way black men who are gay are perceived by society. So that's another... That's a whole other podcast, if you will, on that one. So all of these questions come up. I mean, I go into the classroom to teach just here at Governor State, and I walk in. Obviously, by what I look like, I'm a black male. Now, the question for the students in the room, what kind? Okay. That's powerful because that's the same question asked at grade school. Same question asked in high school. Hopefully I have enough fortitude to know the answer at being age 39. I don't know if I could answer that question well at age 15 because I already went through it myself. I had white friends in Louisiana, and a lot of the brothers didn't like that. They thought that I was too white. I wasn't black enough because my friendship group had white people included. And I remember the angst that did to me, because one, it was kind of physically threatening because they were willing to beat you up for it. But also it was, do I give up what it feels good to me internally? That's that morality I spoke about earlier. Or do I give it up and be inauthentic and just play to my current cultural understanding, which was the group of black kids at that high school at that time? I chose the other side. I'm going to keep my friends because it feels good to me and know my blackness through T.S. Eliot and through Carter G. Woodson, through Fannie Lou Hamer, not through Ready for the World or whatever. Prince, same question. Is he truly black based on his musical styles? And he's not the first. We had Jimi Hendrix. Was he black? And before Jimmy, we had Jackie Wilson. So all of that becomes part of this soup. It really can drive you nuts if you don't have a foundation. And that's where authenticity comes in again. I truly know who I am. I know my grandfathers. I know what their struggle was. I know how hard it was to stand up when the Klan and the sheriff, which are the same in a lot of cases where my parents grew up, were coming down on you.
Okay, so you're not saying that authenticity is about like how you dress or who you hang out with.
Far from.
You're saying true authenticity is knowing your history, embracing it, and speaking up for your brothers and sisters. It's not your sexual orientation. It's not who you hang out with. It's not the music that you listen
exactly
to.
Exactly right.
It's knowing the history and truly speaking up for what is right.
Right, because if you classify it in music alone, you kill Count Basie. You kill Duke Ellington. You kill old Satchmo. And the young people don't understand that. You wipe them off the face of the planet when you say to me to be black is to do like the Ying Yang Twins or the Big Timers. And I ain't, as we say in the street, I ain't mad at them for what they do. But you can't wipe off Duke Ellington, Count Basie, Satchmo. You can't wipe them off because you consider your current historical understanding as blackness.
So the current people are only part of what will become history. They're not
all they're of not history. The history, right. And they couldn't stand on the stage of legitimacy with regard to contract, label, and money if there weren't those brothers playing the, as Ray Charles did, played the Chitlin circuit throughout the South. No, we couldn't stay at the hotels we performed at back in those days. But without the Chitlin circuit, you couldn't have the R. Kelly and Jay-Z tour. Nothing stands alone, and that's the historical amnesia that comes around. You play the big band sound, those two tap dancing brothers who set the stage. The gentleman that danced with Shirley Temple. Mr. Bojangles, as he was called. Even my good, the only famous black person I would want to meet would be Sammy Davis Jr. To see what he had to do to stand up to oppression across the nation, and not when he left America, only when he was in America. And to say you can't, if the Candyman didn't sing, you couldn't have an Usher without the Candyman. And when James Brown died, that's why I just tribute to him on my door, and I sent a tribute across the web on my blog. It's a matter of you got to understand, if you don't understand how powerful it was to say it loud at a time where you can get a baseball bat upside your head for saying anything, then you can't understand why I feel ridiculous hearing things like I'm in love with a stripper on the radio.
Yeah.
As a song at making money. That's where authenticity comes in, because if you operate from a media constructed authentic posture, which I still believe is somewhat by design, then you'll never understand that the more they give you money for the stage, the more they're taken away from the educational doors, the more they're taken away from the community doors, the more they're taken away from the Medicare doors, the more they're taken away from Social Security doors, and you won't have any ammunition for that intellectual fight because you aren't the warrior you could have been because you left out what it meant to be in Birmingham, Alabama in 63. And that was the struggle back then. I am a man. The law says, never right to be here. That's not what we do in large part anymore. Yeah, we have our pockets of great folk who do that. We don't have the young warriors to do it. They're in prison. You can't vote when you come out of me as a felon. That's by design. And when you look at it with regard to a concern of a people, and they can't vote and change the tide of politics, then guess what happens? And that's where the warriors got to get back on track.
Okay. Now, we've talked a lot about the definition of authenticity and a lot about the examples in politics and media and things like that. But what do you think specifically counselors need to know about the impact of black authenticity mm-hmm. when working with black males or African-American males?
First thing counselors need to know is that they don't know either. In my cultural classes, I am not surprised, but somewhat saddened when people say, well, all that stuff, I don't need to know that because my role is just to do this. And I don't know. I say to them all the time, who taught you that mess? You can't have a dynamic in counseling where you are, I want to say ignorant, but don't want to mean that people are ignorant, but where you are unaware of how the spiritual, the mental, and the soul connect with a human being. Now, that might be paradigm choice, that might be awareness choice, but that's the key From Maslow's view of homeostasis, people have their needs by and large met. From a spiritual side, and a lot of us like to think we're spiritual, whether you're white or black or red or brown, you have to connect that dot too. The anger that comes out in other behaviors, we understand that piece when it goes to V-codes and working with youth, but we don't want to understand the same kind of anger when it works to race-based information. Counselors have to recognize you don't know the history either. Most of your academic training, if you are Caucasian and you went to Caucasian institutions, much sadly like black institutions nowadays, don't teach it. They don't bring it up for whatever reason. So you don't know it either. So that's a learning curve. I know when I worked with women's issues, I had a serious learning curve to get into. When I began working with more people from the gay and lesbian populations, especially with the heroin issue and the HIV issue, I know I had to go to school. And I had to put myself in the place where that discussion and that understanding was going on. The chapter in one of my upcoming books about working with gay and lesbians, they sent me 65 pages. I only wanted 30. But I read them all because they brought to me what I didn't know. And so we have to recognize we don't know. The same culture that those black males come out of, we come out of also. And we both did not receive the information. So first, recognize you don't know the impact on their social development, cognitive development, emotional development, and we have to learn that. We have to put ourselves in places and faces and spaces where that information is being discussed. That's number one. Number two, black males, just like a lot of men, have a machismo issue. Gotta be the man. And we have to understand their perceptive or apperceptive, if you will, powers to the world around them. And much of the work that we do will be in the area of their apperception toward the world around them. What the world has taught them could be a cognitive process in some cases, could be an affective process in other cases. But we have to learn how they see the world. That's a very subjective thing. And for some of us, that's very difficult because it evokes various reactions and dynamics in ourselves. And some of us don't want to get involved with that. But sadly, that's the road that we would have to walk down. And they have to recognize, you know what? My dissertation was with African-American males with self-concept. And the biggest finding of all is that they would rather tell you what they are versus what they're not. So they can have everything in their life going down around them. But if their hair is right and they can talk to the ladies, they'll focus on that. They ain't going to worry about they don't have any money as much as you would like to think they do. They're not going to worry about the fact they got to make a dollar out of 15 cents to get groceries this week, although they have to worry about it, and it's strained and it's painful. But when you talk to them, they're going to focus on what they are. So I would take the time to enjoy what they are and then use that data to support how they can conquer the things that are what we would call negative. But you got to maximize what they are. That's the doorway of opportunity, because most times that's what they're going to talk to you about. Now, if you get hip to the jive, as we used to say back in the 40s, and bring in the fact that, you know what, there's a cat named Carter G. Woodson out there who made white people mad. I'm just speaking in street terms, because he developed his own newspaper. And in his own newspaper, he was known as the agitator, because what he did was agitate the cause of freedom. Because he wouldn't let these folk have any rest. He'd always be in their face in the written form. Lastly, we had a gentleman whose brother's murderer was just arrested from 1964 in Mississippi. Man thought to be dead. He didn't give up, but that man didn't say, I'm going to go down there and burn houses down. That man put his head in a direction, what we call that positive energy that Jung likes to talk about, and he put his energies in a direction that brought about closure. Now, the only thing that's different from him to kids today is that word patience. It took time. In the immediate pop culture of today, time is a hard thing to convince any young person to have. Equally or greaterly, is equally harder or more hard for someone who has economic deprivations and has social deprivations and has all these other issues going on to say, wait, it'll get there. In the church, we used to sing a song, Trouble Don't Last Always. trying to talk about you got to wait on God and you got to have patience. Kids, they don't have that. And then when you're equally mad and angry and upset and confused, patience is really not a virtue in that population. So we have to understand that, and we have to be open to letting that frustration come out. We can help tailor how they get it out. I don't want tables being thrown and chairs being tossed, but we have to let that frustration burn out. And we got to give them a safe place to do it and then provide the constructive aspect on the other side.
Okay, so you're saying counselors, no matter what their background,
exactly,
really need to learn the history of the black man and black folk in general, mm-hmm, in the United States. They need to understand how black folk might see the world, especially black men. They need to understand and affirm the strengths of their clients.
Mm-hmm. Very important.
Before they try to go to any, you know, to change anything or you know, looking at what might not be considered strengths in their lives or might be considered negatives. First, they need to understand and affirm the strengths. And then they need to be comfortable being with and hearing some of the anger and angst that people have.
Yeah, that's a big one, because even black counselors, most of whom would be women, we don't like that connoted black rage syndrome. We don't want to see a black man going off in an office where nobody might be on the floor at the time I'm doing my session. That's all part of our cultural gumbo, as I call. And we got to get beyond that. And really, this is not even just for black males in the larger scope. This is what we do for all people. At least I believe ought to be done for all people. But certainly with black men, we carry a couple of stigmas in the room when we show up, especially if we're big and dark and muscular.
That, there's especially a fear.
Special fear for that. That goes back to slave days. The big black buck in the field. John Henry, if you will, the old song about the man who beat the locomotive or the steam drill going through the mountain. Big, strong, and wild. It's like if you saw the Green Mile. And who do they pick for the black role? Big brothers, you know, and they all get worried when that big Negro come walking down the hall, because they know this be a fight right here. All that is in our cultural suit, whether you're conscious about it or it's in the subconscious, the reaction is still there. So we have to let ourselves recognize the counseling environment is for someone to come in and dispense with that. We can teach and model how to do it constructively, but we still should allow it to happen.
Now, this might be a hard question, but if you had to tell counselors three things they should do or know or read or mm-hmm, whatever, three things in order to start understanding black male authenticity, what are three things that you would start them down that path with?
The first, and this is actually a very good question, a somewhat prepared answer in my head because I say this a lot. The first thing, I recommend my favorite book, The Souls of Black Folk by W.E.B. Du Bois, who spoke about Reconstruction. He wrote, this was published in 1903, covering the years after Reconstruction. First black man to graduate from Harvard in 1896. And to read his book today, I believe, provides insight. There's a particular chapter in there called The Training of Black Men. And you'll see how from Reconstruction we've tried to do something about these people. How can we use them in this nation? That's number one. Number two, quite frankly, I say get over yourself, black or white, because we don't know. And it's really hard for a counselor with all our training and degrees, even our workshops, whether it's done by the great Cortland Lee or the great Patricia Arredondo, great Thomas Parham, and all those great, wonderful folk. There's more. There's a whole lot more. And I think we have to put our place in the space of those who have something to say. And we have to be respectful. We have to listen without trying to come up with our own defenses. We have to provide equity and give them their 8 hours instead of us taking eight and they get 20 minutes. And then we have to heal the pain that we have from trying to believe a phenomenon that we have been taught doesn't exist. And I think that's important. The last thing is counselors have to be patient. You have to be patient. It's not going to come out clean. And it's not going to come out quick. You represent, even if you're black, you still represent the other side for someone who believes subjectively that they are truly black, and I or Parham represent white boyism because we did this other stuff. you have to wait on it. And it's not going to be clean, not going to be easy. It's not going to be for the counselor. It'd be easy if we were all blank slates and you can just write on somebody what you want. It's going to take time. And we can't be of the generation we call names to that they're impatient. And then, of course, as therapists, we become impatient. We have to be equally patient. Those are the three things I would suggest.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Dr. Ellis. I appreciate you talking to us about your views about black male authenticity.
Thank you, and wahoo wah.
You've just heard an interview of Dr. Cyrus Ellis by Dr. Shannon Dermer of Governor State University on the topic of black male authenticity in counseling. Look for previous podcasts, show notes, and listener feedback on the podcast website at counselorAudiosource.net. Listeners can leave comments or questions for our interview guests or hosts through our Skype.com internet telephone ID, Counselor Audio Source, or by calling 330-871-4242. Counseling techniques and interventions discussed in the Counselor Audio Source broadcast are meant for use by counseling professionals, and Counselor Audio Source is not held liable for any use of the techniques mentioned in the program. Our music bed today is Memorial Day from Jamie Beauchamp. His and other PodSafe music can be found in the PodSafe Music Network at podshow.com. Counselor Audio Source is licensed under the Creative Commons, a nonprofit organization offering a flexible copyright for creative work.